You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. It's Monday, July 5th, 2010, and today Write the Book will broadcast its first live interview, a conversation with Jacob Paul, author of the new novel, Sarah Sarah, released in May of this year by IG Publishing. Jacob Paul is an associate professor of English at the University of Utah, where he earned a PhD in creative writing and literature. He received his MFA from the Vermont College of Fine Arts. A 9/11 World Trade survivor, he won the 2008 Utah Writers Contest and the 2007 Richard Scowcroft Prize. Sarah Sarah is his first novel. It's the story of a young Orthodox Jewish woman who undertakes a solo kayaking journey across the Arctic Ocean after her parents are killed and she's disfigured by a terrorist bomb in a Jerusalem cafe. Haunted by her parents' death and in particular by memories of her father, a 9/11 survivor whose dream was to kayak through the Arctic, Sarah embarks on her expedition unprepared for the strenuous physical and emotional trial that lies ahead. What begins as a series of diary entries on her struggle with faith ends in a fight for survival as Sarah slowly comes to realize that she is lost in the Arctic wilderness with the ice closing in around her. Welcome to the show, Jacob.
Thank you, Shayla.
So Jacob, you're a 9/11 survivor and you were educated in an Orthodox Jewish school and you're an athlete. Given all of these parallels between your own life and that of your protagonist, I'm wondering if finding your way into this story was it straightforward or was it a struggle?
That's an excellent question. There are a lot of parallel veins, and I think that those are the veins that ultimately are interesting to me. So that's why they're there, and I guess it's no surprise that they would therefore be in my own biography to some extent. That said, when I sat down to write this particular book, I was interested in thinking about most of these questions in a way that was different than the way I'd experienced them personally, which in part is how come my protagonist becomes religious as opposed to leaving religion. That's why my protagonist, Sarah, is not herself a 9/11 survivor, it's her father who's been a 9/11 survivor, which allows me to sneak in some things about my own experiences, but really her encounter with terrorism is very different than anything I ever experienced or ever want to experience. So in that regard, finding her space was always the product of imaginative work and outside of my own process. And in some ways that made it easier, even.
Okay. In reading the book, I was interested in your approach to relaying, I'm going to call her Sarah right now.
That works.
In relaying Sarah's backstory, a lot has happened to her before she begins her journal, and the novel is set up in journal entries, but we learn about it gradually. And at one point early in the novel, she says, "There were those who said I would lose my faith after what had happened, but clearly I kept mine." Although at that point in the novel, the reader doesn't really know what it is that had happened, and Sarah doesn't elaborate at that point. You know, we kind of get hints of what she's gone through before she starts her journey, and I'm just curious how you organized yourself as far as the unfolding of her past story.
Sure. That's right. It is the problem with that book, I think, when I talk about it, is that the whole thing is actually all backstory. So you give someone this long explanation of what the book is, and then you're like, and then the book begins. So it's a little backwards that way. But I think what was going on is that during my time at Vermont College, and I wrote this book right after I finished there, or maybe a year after I finished there, I'd gradually been working towards this understanding of the writing process as being parallel to Stanislavski's method acting technique. And the whole notion inside of his acting technique was that rather than teach actors a whole bunch of different gestural cues that they could use to signal this is sadness, this is happiness, this is distraughtness, this is bloodlust, instead he wanted his characters to feel those things in some sort of visceral way and then allow that to organically inform their motions and actions. And that seemed to me like the way one would want to create narrative voice as well, which I think of as a kind of performance. So for the book, I did create an elaborate backstory, which I then promised myself I would not put in the form of exposition. And having it be a diary that begins when the action begins, in other words, when she actually begins her kayaking journey, sort of forces that to take place. So I had this reservoir of information, and then I allowed her to know that information and then there's not really an agenda to her revealing it. There's rather, I hope at least, a process of her feeling a particular way in a relationship to some component of her backstory, and therefore gradually introducing it. So there are set up mysteries that then get resolved, or if I was going to get really theory-headed, I'd say what Barth calls the heuristic code, or the code in which we try and figure out what happened.
Oh.
That's going on. She's revealing that continuously by giving these little hints as it becomes interesting to her.
Right, and it is so much more interesting as a reader to learn this stuff a little bit at a time and have the mystery hanging out there than it is to read as though she were just dumping her whole past into her journal, which nobody would do. I mean, that's just very artificial.
Right.
Yeah. She uses the vocabulary of Orthodox Judaism. This is another example, I would say, of how she probably would not go into her journal and explain this vocabulary that might be a little bit foreign to certain readers of the novel, but they aren't foreign to her. Words like davening and Hashem and Gai Hinom. And the reader learns what these words mean through context. And I was just curious if you ever considered interjecting more explanations as you wrote, or if you just felt that the context was what was going to help the reader through.
That's a huge question. As one of my very close friends and early readers of a partial draft of the book pointed out, you know, the unknown language in this book is Hebrew and sometimes Aramaic and sometimes Biblical Hebrew, as opposed to, say, French or German. And so it made him feel annoyed that he didn't know what it meant, as opposed to, like, he should get more educated, which seems fair. As you're pointing out, Sheila, though, the character wouldn't obviously naturally feel the need to go and explain these different words, and so I find myself really in this problematic space. And in fact, the fact that she uses those words is a method of displaying how her natural activity would occur. And I don't know that I had really a good solution in the book for that. Sometimes I try and explain it. Sometimes I hope my readers get it through context. In an early draft, I played around with translating everything in footnotes, but that just felt clunky and artificial. I think it's actually maybe a problem in the text, and I hope my readers suffer through it long enough that they can get to the point where they have a context for what's going on, as opposed to just becoming frustrated.
Yeah, actually, I disagree with you. I don't think it's a problem. I think it's true to her character, and so it's the most natural read. Does that make sense?
It does.
I'm not in the habit of disagreeing with my guests, but I think I can this time.
No, it's you're welcome to disagree with me anytime, Shayla. It's probably wise. I think that the reader can get the whole text without actually knowing the translation of the words. Like, and ultimately it creates atmosphere, and having something a little unknown about a character, I think, is actually a good thing. But I guess I'm constantly aware of the fact that there are readers who read a book and want to know what the words inside of it mean, and that seems fair.
Okay, I get it. I'm going to call her Sarah this time. She struggles through the book with her conflicted feelings about religion. She's an Orthodox Jew by choice. She was not raised that way by her parents. And the fact that her choices ultimately led, really innocently, to her parents being where they were when they died, this is all part of the internal conflict that she feels. So I wonder if you can just talk about that a little bit.
Right. Sarah's real conflict, and maybe this is, I guess I had to put it in conflict because I wanted to understand how one would come to the space of religiosity, and I don't mean like understand that, and that seemed like an impossible thing to do, but understand it in kind of a visceral way so it would make sense to me. So it's in conflict, and the reason it's in conflict is because it's a choice she's made, and that choice quite innocently has led her parents to come visit her in Jerusalem, which she would only live in because she became Orthodox, where they do ultimately die. And what that sets up is kind of a choice. She can either say that there is a God who's got full control over her life, in which case she belonged in Jerusalem and the order of the world meant her parents were going to die there, and that's very hard to reconcile with. Or she can say that there isn't a God, or that she chooses not to believe in God, in which case she shouldn't have been in Jerusalem, which means that the kind of adolescent rebellion she demonstrates to her parents was unjustified, and therefore they came to Jerusalem and got killed because she was petulant. Or she has to find some other space that exists between or to the side of those. And I think her struggle is to try and escape that binary that I just described.
I thought it was interesting that her belief system is different from that of her parents. I thought that was a really interesting way for you to show both sides of the equation and the argument that, you know, that exists inside of her and in outside. Just the idea that you show these flashback conversations with her parents where she's expressing her orthodox beliefs and they're expressing their very different beliefs. And I wondered if you, having been raised in Orthodox Jew, is that correct? You were raised in Orthodox Jew,
yes.
So and you're not practicing in that way anymore.
Correct.
So did you find yourself sort of taking both sides of this as you were arguing one point and another?
I suppose a little bit. Yeah, sure. I think also, you know, if we made the imaginative leap that Sarah had an infinite amount of memories of her parents to choose from, she selectively chooses those ones that do counter-argue what she's saying, specifically because she's trying to work through those arguments herself. So it created the space for her to have that back and forth. I think I also wanted to kind of have that space of her parents, because I think that one of the things that interested me when I was writing this was that so many of my peers, having finally grown up kind of in a space of middle-class privilege and really liberated from any notion that they had to offer fidelity to a particular religion or a particular way of being or a particular lifestyle, did find themselves struggling to find larger systems of meaning within which to place themselves. And I think that that is an unexpected side effect of the kind of liberatory rebellions our parents' generation went through.
Mm.
So I was interested in sort of playing with what that would look like mysteriously to her parents, who are like, "We got you everything. Like, you know, you're all set. What's the problem?" She's like, "It's not the right everything." But then who knows if her everything is right either.
Right. That's so true. My husband was a hippie and his son became a Marine, so.
Exactly.
Well, you know what, Jacob, maybe this would be a good time for you to read a few pages from the book.
Sure.
So this is Jacob Paul reading from Sarah Sarah, published by IG Publishing.
Okay, just to give you context, I'm going to read from sort of a little ways into the book. And as Shayla's pointed out, the book is a diary, and the diary begins on July 16th, and I'm going to begin in the middle of August 10th's entry. So this is Sarah. I prepared a dinner of rice and beans cooked with butter and rehydrated eggs and ate it wrapped in flour tortillas. Gradually, while I ate, lifting fog uncloaked a broadening landscape. Finished eating, I benched and davened for the third time, leery of saying nighttime prayers prescribed for sometime after three stars come out and what passes for broad daylight here. Finished with the day's obligations, feeling good, swaddled in fleece, top, bottom, head and toes, and able to see the landscape for the first time in a while, I delicately felt my way down the deep rut my hull carved on the way up to what passes for surf here, my down booties finding there slightly less tenuous purchase than on the rest of the steep slick sand. Near the waterline, the grade relented, and I comfortably walked along surf scum tailings toward a large flat rock I'd noticed on the way in. The rock was about 4 feet high, and I easily climbed on top of it. Scanning the now visible horizon, my intention was to lose myself in a meditation on my mother. I perused the ocean in front, beach and jetty to the left, mountains behind, wondering what she might think if confronted with this brutal landscape, empty of people, jagged and raw and colorful. She'd made fun of it for years. I continued my revolving watch. To my right, where the beach abruptly ended in scrub brush, I saw the glint of glass. I focused. Yes, the low sun caught something amber and reflective. I thought, well, here's evidence of people. Trash is everywhere. I thought to go pick it up and pack it out, but figured that with all the corroded oil drums I passed and not thought to remove, what difference could this infinitely smaller relic make? But I have all the time in the world, in a certain sense. There's nothing for me to do, really, once I've rowed for the day. I was under no obligation or discipline to stay on my rock, thinking about my mother and staring off into space. Literally, when the clouds clear, the horizon here ends in space. I'm confident of it. So I sort of slid/jumped off the rock, smashing out twin booty prints that seep water like a rotten hull, and picked my way across to the shrub. I have to say, I've never felt so self-consciously awkward as I did walking over, completely unobserved, to investigate this oddity in the bush. After several weeks of purposeful motion, this luxurious amble made me feel guilty. And how innocent and clear my mind was then, because this is what I found in the shrub, my whiskey. And I guess I should point out that she'd thrown her last bottle of whiskey into the brink a couple of weeks earlier. Abba and Ima, if you guys are watching over me, please explain what this all means. Am I being tested? Am I meant to hurl the bottle back into the surf whence it reemerged, having so successfully followed me here? Am I supposed to carry it out as trash? Or am I being re-granted the right to drink, having had a recovery of sorts these past several days? Or is the world, in fact, entirely random, as my mother believed? No, I'm way too creeped out to believe that this is entirely accidental. And have I mentioned how pissed I am that in 2 weeks, hard effort rowing? Has it been 2 weeks since I cast off the booze? I should check this journal. I've made no better time than a drifting bottle. Though, in my defense, I have at my best rowed 12 hours in a day, while this bottle has plugged ahead 24/7, no rest stops for it. Or has it? Can't it be possible that it too washed ashore from time to time, only to be sucked out by a changing tide, all the while wondering whether it would be better to go backwards or forwards or just stop for once and for all? Could it not, in fact, have been carried by a playful polar bear great long distances? Ursus Marinus may well have seen that glinting Highland confection and, taking it for reflective bauble, playfully pushed and batted it along the frozen shoreline, carrying it like a dog's toy baby on long northward detours to ice floes past the 85th parallel. Perhaps he showed it to his friends, and in the face of their ridicule, what ferocious white bear, god of the natives, carries a man-made glass liter bottle around with him, abandoned it back to the waves? Or maybe he had it beside him as he lurked on top of a seal's breathing hole, and when making that fateful lunge, slipped tragically on the smooth rolling glass and succeeded in losing at once both libation and dinner. And maybe the seal, inquisitively trailing the stream of bubbles accompanying the bottle's temporary plunge, pushed its savior along the bottom of the ice until it reached open sea again, bidding it a last farewell, safe home, good journey. Or maybe the bear stashed the bottle here temporarily. Or maybe it wasn't a bear at all, but some people in a boat or on a beach who found my whiskey and, expecting some special message in that buoyant bottle, instead found the best of Clan MacAllan, aged in oak 12 years. And those people, as they passed this piece of shore, stashed the bottle for safekeeping. Unlikely, the bottle hardly seemed stashed. It looked as if it had been entrapped on the backwash of a wave, held back in a sieve of stunted willow as the water dropped. No, if in its journey it encountered other humans, they did not willingly leave it there. And yet, they may have parted with it as willingly as I, taking that piece of dangerous trash far out into the ocean and dropping it, hopefully to never return. Or perhaps Hashem, creator of the universe, simply ceased the bottle's existence once I cast it from me, and now, for reasons only known to the divine, has recreated in my path. I don't know. I also don't know whether to have a drink or not. I don't think I'll throw it back just yet. And this is August 11th. Like a donkey after a carrot, I followed the whiskey bottle, duct-taped to my bow all day. It sits there, lowering and ever watchful, never sleeping. Bow spirit, Baruch Hashem. I'll stop there.
Thank you so much. Yeah, polar bears carry Coke, don't they?
Exactly. Why not whiskey?
Right. That whole section just really strikes me about the solitude that she would face doing this trip out in the Arctic by herself, and the madness that might overtake anyone, even without her background. And she does bring this whiskey on the trip with her. She seems to have had a drinking problem before she got there. Is that correct?
I think it gets exacerbated by the loneliness and the grappling.
And I love how she tapes it to the front of the kayak like a carrot.
It's a little bow spirit.
I enjoyed that section. Thank you for reading that.
Sure.
Sarah's father is a 9/11 survivor, as are you. And I'm wondering, Jacob, if I can ask about your 9/11 experience.
Sure.
So maybe you can just talk about it. I know that I read on your website that you actually got to work a little bit late that day, or just you biked to work?
I biked to work, yeah. I actually got there early.
Oh, you got there early.
Which was really unlike me. Generally, I show up to work 15 minutes late, punctually. I started biking to work just like 2 weeks prior, because there was this new greenway that ran along the Hudson River that connected my neighborhood with the World Trade Center. And, you know, I guess I had some ambition that I would be just like Lance, and if I rode my bike to work every day, I'd suddenly be this uber tour athlete. So to do that, though, I had to get there early enough to shower. We had showers in our
That's
building.
That's right.
So it was a beautiful day. I'd ridden my bike in, got up early, had a wonderful ride along the water, parked outside the building, rode up sweaty with some of my coworkers, got in the shower, showered, and While I was there, you know, the first tower was attacked, which of course I had no idea about because I was inside of a shower. No windows, not a lot of sound transference. And while I was drying off, I got that, or they made that announcement, sort of lived infamously on, that Tower 2 was a secure area and there was no need to evacuate. So I kind of casually took off my sneakers, locked up them and my cell phone in a little locker in this bathroom, and then went down to see where all my coworkers were, kind of not thinking anything that big of a deal was going on. And then, you know, the employee who was designated as fire warden was just making a last sweep to make sure everyone was off of our floor. We were really lucky because so many of my coworkers had been in the building during the 93 bombing. They just got out of there. You know, they're really good at evacuating. So everyone was out. And so he said, you know, you should leave. And I still didn't really have any concept of what was going on. So I asked him if I should take the elevator or the stairs. And he's like, the stairs, which was really a good choice. And started walking down the stairs. And when I was on the 28th floor, our building was hit. I was with a bunch of brokerage trainees from, I think, Morgan Stanley, people who've been a couple floors above us, not my company, and they were pretty freaked out because they'd kind of seen what's going on, and I still imagined like a Cessna had crashed into the other building, which was always a fear, and so it was pretty chill until our building got hit too. But everyone really kept it together, and we kind of walked down the stairs and went out through the old mall that had been underground up to the E-train platform, walked the E-train platform, and came out about a block and a half north of the center.
Right.
And then that was really when I got above ground and saw for the first time just kind of the scope of what was going on, and that's where we actually got to see people who were in some kind of state of panic, and we were like, come out of the stairwell, and there's this police officer who clearly run out of ideas of what to do because there's, you know, what was left of a jet engine minus its cowling sitting on the corner. He was wrapping caution tape around it and telling people not to touch it, as if that was something we all wanted to touch. You know, like, there's a piece of airplane engine, I'm gonna go play with it. There's buildings falling down, you know. But that was kind of it.
Now, did you just run?
No, I mean, I think really people still weren't quite sure what to do. I knew because I'd come through the subway platform and there had actually been a train arriving that they were stopping all train traffic, and I imagine they were shutting it down for good, for the day at least. And I ran into, really fortunately, my boss and my lawyer, both of whom I was quite close with, and they were sort of not quite sure what to do, and we all sort of decided we should just start walking because none of us lived near there. It was going to be a long ways home. And I think that was really a great decision because it meant that we were nearly to Houston Street, even though that was only a span of like 15, 20 minutes, but yeah, I think that's about a mile and a half walk, before our building collapsed, and so we were well clear of the, you know, actual catastrophe at that point,
right,
which was great.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
Your character, Sarah, her father, has a great deal of inner conflict after 9/11. He felt, I guess I can put it in the past tense because he's already dead by the time the book opens. He felt angry at tourists who treated Ground Zero as just another sight to see, and he resented the way the city sort of continued on as though it could somehow return to normalcy, you know, once certain efforts to bring things back to a functional efficiency had been realized. So I'm wondering if you felt yourself experiencing similar feelings.
I do think that one of the things that was interesting is, you know, that pretty much, fortunately, just about everyone below the impact zones.
Okay, we're going to take a pause while this fire truck goes by. One thing about the radiator today is it's about 120 degrees up here, and we have to have the windows open, so sorry about that. Okay, I think we'll just soldier on.
So one of the things that I felt, at least at that time, was that there was, you know, there were this group of us, 20 or 30,000 people who escaped the buildings. Just about everyone below the impact zone, minus, of course, the rescue workers, got out, which is really a testament to good evacuation procedures, people acting calmly together, and to those rescue workers
right. Who
were there. But as a consequence, I think we those of us who survived the experience, found ourselves in this sort of dual position of being, at times, politicized, or really actually at that time, I think, actively politicized by the world at large, which sometimes led to people treating us
differently. And I should be really careful when I say us. This was the perception that I had and that I think I sometimes observed in some of the people around me. My company, because we've lost our office spaces, we ended up working inside of other office spaces in different places. My department, along with several others, were located in Hartford at the time. Inside of our parent company had some extra office space. So we're working alongside a bunch of people who live in Hartford, Connecticut. And one of the things I sort of failed to observe was that, on the one hand, there were these people who were treating us explicitly like we had done something active, which of course we hadn't. We walked down some stairs. And then there were other people who were acting as if they'd somehow participated in all this and were like, well, we're taking advantage of it. And that seemed also wrong, like they hadn't been there. And of course, ultimately, the truth is that, you know, either, you know, they're the victims of the event, and then there's everyone who survived, and, you know, everyone who survived, whether they survived it by being in Nepal at the time or by just having walked down the stairs, kind of is in the same boat. But I think figuring out where that space lay was, for me at least, a little bit tense. In particular, I remember, you know, when we were working in those, in Hartford, people had, you know, they'd put out food for us on this table because we were away from home. It was really a sweet gesture, but I think we were a little bit like aliens in those offices, in part because we were actually aliens in those offices.
Yeah.
And at some point, someone put out anonymously this giant, I want to call it a pancake, but I don't mean like pancake you have for breakfast, but the kind of cake you make in one of those disposable aluminum pans, angel food cake with white icing on it, and the World Trade Center towers done up as American flags and icing. It's kind of gaudy.
Yeah.
But, you know, my coworkers and I certainly shared this impulse. I don't mean to sort of cast it off my evil coworkers who were sensitive. Myself, too. Like, we sort of looked at this thing and we're like, you know, what is this? It's ridiculous. And we're probably a little bit vocal about that, you know, yeah. And we don't know. Like, it could have well been that some extraordinarily well-meaning person sitting three cubicles over was, you know, hearing us just bash on this cake that they made, which made me feel kind of guilty afterwards. But, I think that space of the relationship to that cake was a really weird thing.
Yeah, yeah, that's very strange. You know, even if it was well-meaning, it's a pretty strange thing to get through. I mean, everything, how people react.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about the kayaking trip that Sarah takes. I've never been to the Arctic, but the sense of place in this book, in the Arctic scenes, feels absolutely extraordinary to me. And her kayaking scenes are very real with a lot of detail. This is a small section, if I may read it.
Sure.
The small wooden hulled craft twisting and turning across blue-gray chop, wind ripping across the sail, the long planes of already browning grasses dipping and bowing in gusts off to shore. And shore wasn't so close by. I stayed far enough off the coast to avoid maneuvering around every irregular contour in the land. I could just make out a seal sunbathing on a rock spit. Not 15 minutes later, a flock of birds, thick enough to cast a shadow over my boat, executed a broad pirouette to my left. Clouds rushed past at dizzying speeds. My arms flawlessly worked the ropes and boom. So anyway, I'm just wondering if you can talk about researching the book and writing about the Arctic, and if you do kayak.
Sure. I'm decidedly not an avid kayaker. I have been kayaking a few times, so I know how to kayak, and I guess that's good. And I haven't been to the Arctic either, I should confess that. When I began the book, had sort of wanted to think about wilderness as a space that worked alongside of urban spaces with a separate kind of danger to urban spaces, and I wasn't quite sure where I could find a wilderness adventure that would last for as extended a period of time as I wanted for Sarah's kind of mental journey to take place, that would also like not have her encounter other people. You can take long adventures just right in the middle of the country, but you're going to see lots of other people and have lots of opportunity for rescue.
Mm-hmm.
And then I stumbled across John Waterman's article in National Geographic Adventure, which was actually an excerpt from his later published book, Arctic Crossing, which he talks about taking that trip, and I was like, that's the trip. And then I began a long research process. I read his book, I read a number of other books. Ones that stick out are Rowing to Latitude and Victoria Jason's Kabloon and the Yellow Kayak.
Mm-hmm.
I had some confusing questions, and I actually got in touch with John Waterman, who was kind enough to give me some answers.
Oh, great.
And so that's, I think, kind of where I researched the place. I was a really avid rock climber at the time. Still am avid about doing stuff in the outdoors, less rock climbing now. And so, again, going back to that method acting thing, I just tried to inform the fear of exposure one might have while out in a boat on the water to the fear of exposure one might have if slightly too far above a piece of protection placed into a rock cliff. And what I found was that because it was the space of imagination, because I was inventing a thing that I was informing, I felt like it worked pretty fluidly and create a space that worked well with Sarah's space. Whereas in the project I worked on right afterwards, when I did decide to write about rock climbing directly, I found myself constantly caught up in the technical details. You know, I'm thinking there like, so then he places a pink tri-cam into a slightly off-center track, and then, you know, puts into it with the following kind of carabiner, and like I realized like no one in the world cares, even a little bit.
Right.
Like that's just not the right space.
Yeah, it's really hard to balance what you want to inform people of and keep going with the story.
So, right.
Yeah. I'm just curious why you decided to make your protagonist a woman. I'm sure you get this question all the time. I thought you did a really good job, by the way, but it is an interesting choice.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah, I do get that question. I don't know why I didn't think I would get that question until I had my first agent for the book, and the first thing he says to me is like, you know, we're gonna have a hard time selling this book with you as a guy. And I was like, well, what's our plan B for that? And there didn't really seem to be a good one. But I chose, in part, it just seemed to me like this character was a woman when I began developing her backstory. I don't really know why, but then I was also trying to create a character who was going through all these different journeys than my own journey, and oftentimes inverse journeys to my own journey. And so I was kind of consciously trying to create distance between myself and the character, and I think gendering her female was one of the ways in which I did that. And it is something I still do feel really cautious about. I mean, I felt very much, and I still feel very strongly, that Sarah's not meant to somehow be representative of women in any more than she or her father are supposed to be representative of 9/11 or terrorism survivors. She's ultimately just a singular character who happens to be a woman in this particular instance. I do also think along those lines that whenever you're constructing characters, you are creating an entity that's separate from yourself, that has to be fully formed, and ultimately that forming comes out of some sort of imaginative space, as opposed to being something you can just kind of do because it's something you know. You're always inventing.
Okay, thank you for that.
Sure.
I'm sorry about the fire trucks.
Well, it seems suitable, appropriate.
I know, well... another interesting part of Sarah Sarah, I thought, has to do with an imagined future storyline that gives her hope when she's feeling hopeless and kind of keeps her going and allows her to create another world for herself when things in this particular ice-bound world are going particularly poorly. How did you come up with this idea? And her, she invents a character named Udi, is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, who's sort of the future lover that she expects to someday meet. So how did you come up with that whole, I thought that was really creative.
Sure, I think there had been like sort of two abstract experiments I've been interested in exploring, perhaps even really before I stumbled across Sarah as my character. One of them was that I wanted to think about, again, the comparative dangers of an urban space and a wilderness space. The other was that I was really curious about what it would mean to write in the future tense, and I had no idea how I was going to do that. And the two things, once I began, got closer to what was going to be my story, sort of dovetailed really nicely, because that future tense gave me the opportunity to position Sarah inside of a city. And also it seemed to me that the way that people sort of survive trauma, maybe, and sometimes maybe survive adventure, though I'm of mixed feelings about this, is that they begin to imagine that there is a space beyond that, that the here and now is actually not really where one is, but the here and now is what one's doing to get someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what Sarah does. She begins to think, like, I've got to row every day. I'm sort of beset by trauma, which is like leading her to be quite depressed, and that depression is leading her to not want to row, and the failure to row means that the Beaufort Sea will ice up, which means you can't row, which means you can't get out, which is catastrophic, you die.
So she begins to think that if she just can manage to row each day, she'll be able to get back to Jerusalem. If she gets back to Jerusalem, things will be better. She'll be sort of healed of all of this because she'll have this accomplishment behind her. This last wilderness adventure will be out of her way, and she can really embrace her religious self, as opposed to the secular self that's kind of taking this journey and grappling with her religious self. So, yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that, I don't know if you intended this or not, but as I was reading the book, I felt a lot of hope for her. I really felt like she was going to succeed in her adventure or in her journey, because she created this future for herself rather than recreating her past and changing in her mind, which would have been madness, I suppose, but she is a little mad at certain points.
Everyone goes mad being alone.
Yeah.
On a journey too long.
Yeah, maybe. So, and she didn't recreate her parents' outcomes, and I thought that probably meant that she was a little saner than she, you know, might otherwise have been. Sarah increasingly endures terrible fear and pain and hardship as the book continues, and she struggles to maintain her faith, and she considers Job, the book of Job, and the comparison is so perfect. I wondered if that was, I mean, it's a fairly natural analogy to come up with, but on the other hand, I wondered if Job was one of your initial inspirations.
You know, I had a real, my initial inspiration was to include pieces of the Psalms. In part because I've always been really interested in how they translate. They're kind of a bizarre piece of text. They stem from the Eucharist tradition, which precedes Judaism in around Haifa. And so, you know, you have like Baal, God of the skies, showing up, and the God of the rivers. And God inside of the Psalms is always kind of a weirdly mixed character. But I still wanted to use them just kind of tangentially with Sarah, because after all, like, they're also the prayer you'd say in a time of danger. And she's sort of perpetually in a time of danger. And, you know, I'm flipping through the Book of Psalms, I suddenly realized that, you know, tacked in there as an even stranger addendum is the Book of Job. It's part of the Book of Psalms. I thought, you know, like, why would this be in a place where people are looking to say prayers about danger? And I don't have a good answer to that, but as soon as I started reading the Book of Job, I sort of thought, you know, this was the right thing for her.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really been fun having that in the book, because when I do regular readings, I'm feeling like I can be self-indulgent, I'll read that section and I get to feel like a tent preacher, which is always my backup profession.
Okay, thank you. Did you know what the ending of the book was going to be? I'm not going to say what the ending of the book is, but did you know where you were going when you began to write?
I don't think so. I think that one of the fun things about writing this project was that kind of once I had my parameters in place, in other words, like, I knew what went into taking this kind of a journey, I knew how long it would take, so what was at stake in that, I knew the backstory, so I knew what Sarah would be grappling with and who she was, and then I sort of knew what she was going to do. I knew that there was going to be a future tense, which might include a romance. Then I kind of had free rein. I could, you know, innovate and play, really, inside of that, and that was great. And I don't think I knew how it was going to end or where that end was going to be, and I think that probably until I was halfway or two-thirds of the way through the book, I didn't even really realize what kinds of questions the conclusion would seek to answer or resolve.
Right. Just to leave this little cliffhanger, I enjoyed the way you ended the book.
Thanks.
That was great. Okay. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the process of finding a publisher for Sarah Sarah.
A little bit might be the wrong way of phrasing that question, sure. Initially, you know, I thought for sure I was going to be like a super famous person immediately, because I had this earlier really troubled manuscript I'd written before writing Sarah Sarah that I had been gradually trying to get published, looking for an agent while I was writing Sarah Sarah, and as soon as I finished Sarah Sarah, I've been so frustrated trying to find an agent for that book, which in retrospect I'm kind of glad I didn't, because I don't want to publish it anymore. You know, I was like, I'm just going to stick this thing in the mail and see if it does any better, you know, and the first agent I sent it to immediately said, I want to represent you, and this was like, so I had an agent within a week of finishing what I thought was like a pretty good second draft, but maybe not even a final draft. So I was like, that's it, every, you know, tomorrow I'll
I'll be on New York Times bestseller list.
Or at least the Today Show.
At least it's at a minimum, though it's way cooler up here in this funky radio station.
Oh, thank you.
Absolutely. But, you know, then what happened is gradually that relationship, well, the relationship with the agent was just fine, but I was out of town, and he was young and ambitious, but apparently losing his sense of ambition for agenting. So it was kind of this long period where the book was sent out very slowly, and that process gradually stalled out. By the time it had finished stalling out, I was unsure of what to do about the book, and much of the way through another project, which I thought maybe I should just keep working on this project, maybe that's how this process goes. So then I kind of sat on the book for a while, and then eventually I began sending it out to small presses sporadically, it to agents sporadically, intermingled with trying to send the new text out. And then I kind of tried to ramp up my game. I built myself a website, which was a really useful tool, because it allowed me to send out a very brief query email to agents that then sent them to the website where, you know, they'd already taken the first step of looking at something.
Right.
And then they could see a lot of information and kind of move through it fluidly. Once I did that, I then found a couple of small presses at the AWP conference, talked to those guys, sent them query letters, sent query letters actually to three presses. One of them, IG, immediately said they wanted to see, they were like, just send us both manuscripts. And they read Sarah Sarah first, and they're like, we like this one. And so they didn't even bother to look at the other one. And I was like, great. I actually thought they'd like the other one better. It seemed like the way they described themselves, it seemed more appropriate. But then,
so it's IG, it's not IG.
It's IG.
It's IG, okay.
Yeah, so I think IG works just fine.
Yeah.
It might even be more descriptive.
Okay, great. Let's see. You teach at the University of Utah.
Yeah.
So how do you make time for your writing with your teaching?
Sure. Well, the nice thing about sort of teaching adjunct, besides that, you know, you get to be poor enough to not worry about anything, is that you you kind of teach sporadically. So mm-hmm. I do have a pretty push schedule, but even when I have like a busier schedule, I find as long as like that kind of is made into a priority. I remember when I was working in finance still, talking to Doug Glover, who I believe you've also interviewed,
mm-hmm.
He was at some reading or something, and someone was asking about how they should quit their job so they can write, and he got really exasperated. He was like, I've never written a book when I wasn't under duress. You know, like, I've always had to work full time, and I've never had health insurance. I think that's kind of true. Like at some point, you know, there's a real burnout level if you have too much writing and too much work to do, but
right,
you just have to do both.
You have to do both. Okay. I just have really one more question for you.
Okay.
And that is, what advice do you have for writers who occasionally get stuck in their work or have trouble moving forward?
Sure. I think the best advice I've actually heard about, I'm going to punt, is when I was an undergraduate, I took a bunch of creative writing classes from Raymond Fetterman, who was kind of, you know, at the forefront of the American experimental movement back in the 70s. He started the first fiction collective, which preceded the Fiction Collective too. And, you know, his answer was simply like, as soon as you don't know what to write about, just start writing about the fact that you don't have anything to write about.
Uh-huh.
And while in the short term that can certainly lead to, you know, perhaps a big mess of uninteresting metatextual stuff, in the long term it can start to write you into the spaces I think you want to be in,
right,
to move forward in your process.
Okay.
Like I find, yeah.
Okay, great. Well, that's very helpful. Thank you. Thank you so much for talking with me today, Jacob.
Oh, thank you so much, Shayla, for having me on your show.
So that was Jacob Paul. His new book is Sarah Sarah, and it's published by IG Publishing, not IG, but IG. And to learn more about Jacob's work, you can check out his website, jacobgpaul.com. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. More information is available at autismsupportdaily.com or 802-985-8773. And by the Lake Champlain Regional Chamber of Commerce, promoting and supporting a healthy environment that makes Burlington the ideal place to live, work, visit, and do business. Located at 60 Main Street in Burlington and online at vermont.org. And by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, building a brand new economy with old-fashioned values. Learn more at vbsr.org. And by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world. internet, television, telephone, burlingtontelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic network. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. Howard Norman will read from his new book, What Is Left the Daughter, at Bear Pond Books in Montpelier on Tuesday, July 6th at 7, and he'll also be at Phoenix Books and Cafe in Essex on Saturday, July 10th at 7. The Fletcher Free Library in Burlington continues its Odyssey book discussion series on Wednesday, July 7th at 7:30 to talk about Margaret Atwood's book, Penelope Yod. David Herlilly, author of The Lost Cyclist, will be at the Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Thursday, July 8th at 7. I'm not sure I said his name right. It's H-E-R-L-I-H-Y. Herlihy. And then John Clinch, author of Kings of the Earth, will be at the Northshire on Friday, July 9th at 7. And the actor Treat Williams, who has a new picture book out called Air Show, will be at the Northshire on Saturday, July 10th at 2. Finally, Ruth Kassinger, author of Paradise Under Glass, will be at the Northshire on Saturday, July 10th at 7. This week's Write the Book prompt was inspired by the work of my guest, Jacob Paul. Write a scene or a poem in which a small conflict is resolved through action or even adventure. So, for example, a character who's a little bit hungry but has no money tries to steal food from a convenience store. Or a character who was once pickpocketed witnesses a purse snatching and plays some role in interrupting the crime. Or a character who longs for warm weather goes skiing. It doesn't need to be an enormous inner conflict or a Job-like act of valor, but use action to impact conflict in some small way. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And you can check out upcoming shows by looking at my blog, writethebook.wordpress.com. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. And stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby will bring you the world of music at 3 o'clock. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.